Ladies and gentlemen, we're about to get started, so if people take their places and get comfortable, there is plenty of seats up here in the front, if you want to come forward a little bit more. My name is Alan Middleman. I'm the director of the Jews in the American Public Square Project, sponsored by the Pew Charitable Trusts and organized by the Center for Jewish Community Studies in Philadelphia. I'd like to introduce you to the director of the Boisy Center here at Boston College, who's graciously agreed to co-sponsor this event with us, and that's Professor Alan Wolf, who I think needs no introduction.
We at the Boisy Center, Patty Chang, and I, are just delighted to be co-hosts of this event. And for those of you who haven't been here before, welcome to Boston College, and in particular, welcome to the Irish heart of Boston College, Gasson Hall, room 100.
Our sponsor is the Jewish Community Relations Council of Greater Boston, and its president is here, Mr. Jeff Lewis.
Thank you very much. I'm here to bring greetings from the local Jewish community. As many of you may know, the Jewish Community Relations Council is an umbrella organization of, I believe we are up to 43, is that right, Alan? 43 different Jewish community organizations, and we try to speak with one voice, which is a perfectly impossible exercise because, as anybody who knows the Jewish community knows, there are many, many voices there. But we do try to coordinate policy to some extent. We're obviously delighted to have this conference, and we're very happy to be a part of this conference. I think it's dealing with an issue that we take very much to heart, since we do represent very much American Jewry, profoundly involved in the public square. So we look forward to hearing from our speakers, and thank you all for coming. And I do want to say that as a Boston College undergraduate, the class of 1974, it's great to be back in this great hall, which has a lot of very good memories for me. So thank you.
Well, lest I forget at the end, I want to express my personal thanks to Alan Wolf and to Patricia Chang, a professor here in the sociology department and the associate director of the Boisy Center, for helping to organize this, and to Nancy Kaufman, the director of the JCRC, who couldn't be here tonight, but Alan Ronkin, who is here. I'll tell you just a couple of things about this project before I introduce the speakers. 4 years ago, the Pew Charitable Trusts in Philadelphia were interested in supporting research on how major American religious communities become politically engaged and civically engaged, and moreover, how they think about their own engagement in the metaphorical public square. Together with my late friend and teacher, Daniel Elazar, and Professor Jonathan Sarna of Brandeis, who I'm sure is no stranger to many of you, we got the grant from the Pew Trusts to do a three-year project on the American Jewish community. So we have two books coming out looking at all aspects, historical, sociological, political, even philosophical and theological, on Jews as American citizens. We have sponsored two public opinion research surveys with Professor Stephen Cohen of Hebrew University doing the research. We have a newsletter, a website, and we were to have, on September 12th and 13th, a concluding event, a national conference in Washington, D.C. That, of course, was canceled on the morning of September 11th. And like everyone else, it took us a long time to even begin to recover. So instead of a national conference, we're having several conferences around the country, and this is the first one. We have here tonight four very accomplished and distinguished scholars and activists. I will introduce them to you all at once, and they will each speak for no more than 15 minutes, and then in the remaining time, we'll have discussion. The first speaker is Professor David Novak, who holds the J. Richard and Dorothy Schiff Chair of Jewish Studies at the University of Toronto. He's professor of the study of religion, professor of philosophy there. He has appointments in Toronto's University College, as well as the Faculty of Law, the Joint Center for Bioethics, and the Institute of Medical Science. And Professor Novak is the director of the Jewish Studies program. Prior to coming to Toronto, he was the Edgar M. Bronfman Professor of Modern Judaic Studies at the University of Virginia. Professor Novak was born in Chicago and received his A.B. from the University of Chicago, his Master's of Hebrew Literature from the Jewish Theological Seminary in America, as well as his rabbinical ordination, and his Ph.D. in philosophy from Georgetown University. David Novak is a frequent contributor to journals such as First Things. He has a host of academic honors, which would exhaust the entire hour and a half if I were to go through them. Most recently, he delivered the Lancaster Yarnton Lectures in Judaism and Other Religions at Oxford University and at Lancaster University. He's lectured throughout the world. He's the author of 11 books. I think I've read about five of them. The latest being Covenantal Rights, which is a study in Jewish political theory. Professor Michael Broyd, seated in the center, is Associate Professor of Law at Emory University School of Law and the Academic Director of the Law and Religion Program at Emory University. His primary areas of interest are law and religion, Jewish law and ethics, comparative religious law. Besides Jewish law, Professor Broyd has taught federal courts, alternative dispute resolution, secured credit, bankruptcy, and other courses. He received his Doctor of Law degree from New York University. And in addition to this, he is ordained a rabbi by Yeshiva University and is a member, a dayan, a judge of the Beit Din of America, the largest Jewish law court in America. He's published more than 50 articles in various aspects of religion and Jewish law. Dr. Michael Gottsagen, seated to my left at the end, works for CLAL, the Center for Learning and Leadership, and he's the editor-in-chief of eCLAL, an online journal of religion, public life, and culture. He also directs CLAL's internet operation. He received his PhD in political theory from Columbia University and is currently at work, I find this truly amazing, on his PhD in religion at Harvard University. So two PhDs soon. He's taught political philosophy at Columbia and Jewish philosophy at Brandeis and has written The Political Thought of Hannah Arendt, his study of Hannah Arendt's contribution to political theory. And to my right is Kevin Seamus Hassan, the president and general counsel of the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty in Washington. As president and general counsel of the Beckett Fund, Kevin Hassan has defended the religious rights of Catholics, Protestants, Muslims, Jews, Buddhists, Sikhs, and Native Americans in cases throughout the country in courts at all levels. Before founding the Beckett Fund in 1994, he was an attorney at Williams & Connolly in Washington, D.C., where he focused on religious liberty litigation. From 1986 to 87, he was in the Office of Legal Counsel of the Justice Department, where he advised the cabinet departments on church-state relations. He is a 1985 magna cum laude graduate of Notre Dame Law School and also holds a master's degree in theology from Notre Dame. And he's appeared in numerous public debates, both in universities and in the national media, and you can often see him in the Washington Post. Okay, without further ado, Professor Novak.
Yeah. Sure. The project that we're part of with funding from the Pew Charitable Trust is, as I understand it, to develop a public philosophy, and understood in the broad sense of that term, for American, although I must, as now I'm a Canadian as well, say North American Jewry. I think that when this is to be done, Jews in North America have to look at such a definition against two backgrounds. Number one, what is our relationship with the larger American or Canadian society of which we are citizens? And number two, against the background of the Jewish state in the land of Israel, the state of Israel, of which our relationship is one that still has not been fully thought out in terms of either by Israelis or, for that matter, by Jews in the diaspora, primarily because the situation in Israel politically and militarily has always been so volatile that we really haven't had the leisure to do this kind of thinking in any systematic, let alone public, way. That being said, I think that I'm going to make an initial assumption and indicate why I think this must be the working assumption for Jews who are self-conscious about their Jewish identity, certainly in any diaspora community, and perhaps even in Israel as well, and then indicate how I think this plays out. My assumption is that a Jew owes absolute loyalty to only one community, and that community is the Jewish people. That Jews are part of the Jewish people, and according to Jewish tradition, can neither enter the Jewish people of their own will — even somebody who converts is actually basically converted, they don't convert themselves, they're also chosen in a way — and one cannot exit the community even if one chooses another identity. As far as the community is concerned, you neither check in of your own volition and you cannot check out of your own volition. This is how I understand the fundamental loyalty of a Jew. And from my own perspective, theologically considered, this is precisely because God has chosen the Jewish people, and therefore, as someone who's been born into the Jewish people, I am part of that election. That status of a Jew within the Jewish people is not the same — and I want to point that out, especially in terms of living in a non-Israeli society — is not the same as my loyalty to the state of Israel. My loyalty to the state of Israel is to a state of which I happen not to be a citizen, but nevertheless which I think is very much working in the best interests of the Jewish people. But there again, it is not a polity that can — no polity, no humanly created polity can make the absolute claims upon me that the Jewish people can make upon me. The Jewish people, that is, as constituted by the Torah. What the rabbis called Knesset Yisrael, the congregation in the cosmic sense of that term. Now, if that is the case, then some people would find — many Jews would be uncomfortable with that kind of an assumption, because what does that mean in terms of our being participants in a society such as the United States and Canada? However, I don't find it inconsistent. There's a difference between being a part of the Jewish people, like the part of a body, and being a participant in a democracy. Because the thing about democracy that is so attractive to Jews, and I would think to other peoples of other traditions as well, especially religious traditions, is a democracy does not make the absolute claims upon me that the Jewish people make upon me. The Jewish people make a claim upon me, for example, to reproduce, to bring Jewish children into the world. A secular state cannot make that claim upon me. The Jewish people require that if need be, I die as a martyr rather than become something else. A secular state might require me to risk my life in war, but it does not require me to die as a martyr. In other words, there is only inconsistency in terms of this absolute loyalty to the Jewish people if one regards participation in a democratic society to be a competing absolute loyalty. But I would argue that one's participation in a democratic society is precisely because it does not make absolute existential claims upon me. And therefore, when a democratic society does make these type of claims upon me, it is no longer really functioning democratically as understood, let's say, in a constitutional democracy. Now, that being said, therefore, I think that when Jews, and here I'll speak of diaspora Jews, specifically North American, that is, United States and Canadian Jews, make decisions or attempt to formulate positions in the community on questions of public policy, I think that there are three criteria that have to be consulted. Three criteria that have to be consulted, all of which are consistent with, if not derived from, our ultimate and complete loyalty to the Jewish people as, I would theologically define it, as the elected community of God. The first, and it's a question of which order one goes in terms of approaching questions, but I would say that the three are as follows. Number one, an aspect of Jewish public policy, when the Jewish community or any, and when we mean the Jewish community, we really mean the Jewish communities, but when any organized group of Jews in our society make a public policy position, I think that it has to consult three criteria. Number one, it has to be consistent with the Torah. It has to be consistent with the Torah and Jewish tradition. Now that can mean one of two things. It can mean in some cases that literally we have to have a halachic warrant. We have literally have Jewish law has to regard this as something that either ought to be done or ought not to be done. In a number of cases of public policy, it cannot possibly be that legally specific, but even then, one has to look upon a public policy stand. Is this something that contributes to the overall purposes that Jewish thinkers have derived from the Torah, the overall values, if you will, or general principles of the Torah? Is this something which is consistent with them and furthers them or not? So it's either a specifically halachic decision, for example, if you want to have a public policy statement on a physician-assisted suicide, I'll give an example in medical ethics, here's something where you really do have to consult literally the halacha, Jewish law, to decide what is should be the case. In other situations, like, school vouchers, you can go on and on about these things, one has to look at it in a broader sense. So that's criterion number one. Criterion number two is the self-interest of the Jewish people. The self-interest of the Jewish people. This is something, by the way, that is more understandable in a Canadian context than in an American context. And the reason is because whereas the American notion of polity is very much based upon the idea of the social contract, that we are individuals who've come together to create a polity, in Canada there's much more of a notion of what are called founding peoples. That is, the people who've made up the polity do not do so as anonymous individuals, but do so as very much part of earlier, older communities. So that, for example, in Canada, the founding nations, English and French, and then later recognized the, what we call the original peoples, really not only meant English and French, it really meant either Catholic or Protestant. And when Jews became a factor in Canadian life, then, of course, it had to be expanded in terms of a founding a people. So therefore, what is in the best interest of the Jewish people? And especially the Jewish people living in that society, but even the Jewish people worldwide. And the third aspect that has to be is what I would consider to be general morality. Now, general morality is also something which, if not derived from the Torah, is at least endorsed by the Torah. That's a kind of a philosophical debate in Judaism. That is, the Jewish tradition either teaches or recognizes, there's a difference, the fact that there are a number of moral standards that we regard as binding on all people. as binding on all people. Not so much because we say that's what other people should do, not kind of imperialism, but because it's recognized, in fact, in the Jewish tradition, that these standards were in place even before the Jews accepted the Torah, and the Torah did not repeal these standards. The Torah improved upon them, elaborated on them, but did not basically repeal them. So you have the three criteria of the teaching of the Torah, either specifically legal or more generally theological, the best interest, the self-interest of the Jewish people, and general morality. Now, at times, there are going to be conflicts, or seeming conflicts, between these three criteria. There are times that Jews might think that what is in their best self-interest really is something that would be contrary to the Jewish tradition. In that case, I would say, as a traditional Jew, that the tradition trumps our notions of self-interest, that we have to rethink what is the self-interest of the Jewish people so that minimally it doesn't contradict the Torah and maximally actually puts it into practice. There are times that people will see a conflict between general morality and what is in the best interests of the Jewish people. I think that this is a difference that's apparent, not real, because the Jewish tradition clearly recognizes that all of these standards that the Jewish tradition recognizes as being a general, even universal morality, are built into the Jewish tradition. There's a principle in the Talmud that says that there is nothing that is prohibited to the Gentiles, which is permitted to the Jews. In other words, Jewish morality is supposed to be stricter, not more lenient, than what we regard as binding on everyone else. So that therefore, Jews can make claims upon one another that do not contradict general morality, but actually, in effect, add to it or raise it to another level that we could not expect of other people. But there are certain minimal kind of moral standards. So therefore, I think that all of this is, these factors have to be taken into consideration. And I think that one of the problems in Jewish public policy kind of thinking is that all three factors are frequently not taken into consideration. In other words, there's a certain type of Jewish public policy. I think of the type of Jewish public policy that is especially wedded to liberal notions of polity, liberal notions of strict separation of church and state, that basically will only look at kind of general principles. And Jews will argue for this not as Jews, but simply as anonymous citizens of the society. There's another segment of the Jewish community that will simply argue what is in the best interest of the Jewish people without considering whether this is consistent or not with any kind of general morality or whether it's consistent with the full teachings of the Torah. And then, of course, there is a point of view of some Jews, especially of a very traditional or Orthodox variety, who will only consult the Torah and the tradition and will not be concerned at all about any kind of general morality and will not be concerned even about what is in the best interests of the Jewish people, because frequently what's in the best interests of the Jewish people or even general morality can influence the way one interprets the Torah. So there's kind of there's a dialectic here. There's a interrelationship between these three factors of the Torah and Jewish tradition, the best interests of the Jewish people, and questions of a general morality. I think that this is a very propitious time for such a project as what is being sponsored by the Center for Jewish Community Studies that we are under their auspices here this evening. Because I don't think it has been until very recently that Jews have felt comfortable enough in the United States, let alone Canada, which in many ways is a newer Jewish community, have felt comfortable enough in the society to actually really want to formulate a coherent Jewish policy. Most of Jewish public policy until very recently, and even until this day in many cases, has been a very kind of defensive kind of posture, a kind of posture that we really don't believe that we are insiders in this society. We're really a vulnerable, marginal, sort of group. And therefore, it's only until recently that we have felt comfortable and secure enough, not only as citizens but as Jews in the society, to formulate this kind of policy. And I would suggest it be formulated based upon these three criteria. Thank you.
Thank you very much, David.
I confess, as I was listening to Dr. Novak, I didn't know if I should respond to what he said, because he spoke so eloquently, and yet, in my view, not at all my sense of where the Jewish tradition lies. Or should I say what I wanted to say, completely ignoring his opening remarks? And I'm going to try to do both. And I know I'm going to be subject to a squeeze play afterwards, which is okay. That's a part of the intellectual give and take. I'll start with my premises, and then I'll move on to my conclusions. In my view, the Jewish tradition is made up of a set of internal rules which intensely govern, regulate, dictate, and demand the way Jews behave, internal to themselves, and that we can call these set of laws Jewish law. Part of Jewish law is an obligation to obey and participate in secular society and to observe the rules of secular society. Jewish law does not mandate, in the classical sense of the word mandate, in the sense of compel or direct, an overt participation in the secular world so as to make the secular world a better place. Such activity is at best can be described as encouraged. Even though Jewish law does have a universal code that predates Jewish law, we'll call that the Noahide Code, which it imposes upon everybody, it's not part of Jewish law in the classical sense of the word that we would use this term, and Jews bear no obligation to participate in the secular society out there around us to ensure morality by the community that we live in. This is a very basic, important philosophical point that I start with that I suspect Dr. Novak does not agree with. So it's important to put it to you in my Jewish law view rather than my Jewish philosophy view. Even though we recognize very intensely that non-Jews are bound by a moral code, and that moral code creates right and wrong for Gentiles, Jewish law does not dictate that Jews be in the business of enforcing morality in the secular community, and that we are allowed a much greater sense of laissez-faireness towards secular society than we are towards our internal Jewish community. All Jews are interconnected one with another, and we recognize as matters of theology that we are judged not only by our own righteous activity, but by the good and bad activity of the community of Jews around us. We do not, as a matter of Jewish law, or in my view, Jewish philosophy, feel that way about the broader community around us. It is nice and proper that the community around us behave well, and we would not be in a situation of affirmatively encouraging misconduct by the community around us, but centrally, we bear no obligation to seek enforcement of universal law and morality on the secular world around us. This should not be understood to mean that we don't believe there is such a morality. It's that we are not the world's policemen, and we were not put on this earth to be chosen in that role. To the extent that we believe in the notion of being a light unto the nations, it is in the model of the famous Radak, a medieval commentary on the Bible, a lighthouse. Lighthouses stay in one place and illuminate. They do not go around shining light on people who do not wish to be shined on. They stay and illuminate. Those who wish to be found in the light of the lighthouse draw close to it. This is very, very important to understand. So my basic moral premise, my starting point for how I understand Jewish law, diminishes in dramatic, substantive ways how I sense our obligation to the outside world. So when we start by summarizing the propositions in Jewish law as I see them, proposition number one is Jewish law imposes an obligation to compel observance of Jewish law upon Jews in any circumstances that we can. There are many circumstances that we can't, But we bear an obligation to enforce Jewish law to the greatest extent of our own ability on fellow Jews. In modern times, this is vastly curtailed because we live in a free and open society, and thus we don't enforce Jewish law. But on the other hand, even as we cannot enforce Jewish law, we nonetheless recognize an obligation to inform people who are bound by Jewish law what they ought to be doing, even if they are going to ignore us. So we bear an obligation to be guardians of Jewish values for the Jewish community. Even if nobody will listen to that which we say, we bear a duty to say it forcefully and clearly so everyone should understand. In my view, we bear no such obligation to the world at large. And even when we know what is going on in the world around us and we know it to be wrong, we are permitted to stand by silently and not participate, and certainly not denounce the immorality that is running around us. Having said that, it's a good thing to do. Denouncing immorality is a good thing to do for five different reasons. The simplest of which is immorality has a creeping influence on your own conduct. And thus you really don't want to live in a bad society. If there is a single lesson of the biblical story of Lot, Abraham's nephew, it was that it is very hard to be a good person among the Sodomites. And that's a lesson that we all need to learn. But, and this is a very important but, this is not a moral mandate that's an imperative in the Jewish tradition. In the same way that, as I understand the Jewish tradition, there is an imperative to tell people what Jewish law is when they will listen and obey. From that starting point, we move readily to a discussion of practical politics that I confess reaches a completely different result from that Professor Novak has articulated for you. Since we bear no profound obligation to society around us, Jewish communities bear not a moral obligation to participate in a way that articulates the values of Judaism, but instead they bear an obligation to participate in ways that make the world a better place. And making the world a better place is a very practical observation, grounded not in proclaiming morality, but grounded instead in a complex balance of the internal needs of the Jewish community with the external needs of the secular community, with other values as well. With other values, which is simply our obligations to be a good citizen, our obligations not to make too many enemies, our desire to live peacefully among our neighbors without continuously being the clarion call of who's doing what wrong item to whom. So to me, when you pursue a project of Jewish political ethics, I confess, I'm silent. I think that Jewish public ethics, when it comes to what the American government ought to be done, is merely practical politics designed to facilitate the long-term best interests of the Jewish community, and it allows participating in the sense of joining coalitions that permit things that are naked violations of Jewish law. And the reason why that is so is a very important one. The secular society that's out there isn't ours. It's not where I, either as a member of a Beit Din or a synagogue rabbi, put forward my vision of morality. We are comfortable with the separation of church and state, and we desire that morality take place in the church part, which we'll call the synagogue, and the state part will be an articulation of practical political activity that's designed to facilitate the best interests of the community as a whole. So I will give you three examples just to lay out for you my sense of how the Jewish position works. I'll consider one example that I didn't come in prepared to discuss, but which Dr. Novak mentioned, which is physician-assisted suicide. In my view, physician-assisted suicide is substantively a sinful violation of Jewish law that frequently comes close to murder. So were a congregant to raise his hand in my small synagogue and ask about physician-assisted suicide, I would say such conduct is prohibited. A patient who kills himself in that manner should be treated as one who commits suicide, and a doctor who kills a patient in that manner ought to be treated as a murderer. And that would be my answer in the synagogue. Having said that, the question of whether we should encourage or discourage physician-assisted suicide being lawful in the United States is a completely different discussion. And it's grounded not in whether Jewish law permits or prohibits this activity, but is instead grounded in a political calculus that balances the desire that Jewish law not have this activity occur within its community with the realization that freedom and the rights of personal autonomy are treasured values in the Jewish tradition, and letting people kill themselves, as sad as it sounds, sometimes is a way that people are manifest their freedom. And freedom has a large value to the Jewish community, even if some people use their freedom in violations of Jewish law. My second example is gay rights. A little bit more controversial, but equally important. Homosexuality, homosexual conduct, represents a substantive violation of Jewish law, which in the Orthodox and the conservative tradition, and really with anybody who has a close affiliation with the Jewish tradition, recognizes as sinful. And were you to ask in a rabbinic context, one would be told this clearly. Having said that, again, we have, in my view, no clear answer to the question of whether civil rights for homosexuals is a good idea or a bad idea. It might well be that guaranteeing civil rights for all, even as this permits, this in essence enables homosexual activity in society, is nonetheless a good idea, because the granting of civil rights to all creates values in society that are hospitable to the Jewish community. After all, as a minority faith in a country with a strong tradition of religious liberty, but nonetheless a fragile one, we continuously need to ensure that the rights of people to be different are protected. And maybe that's the right answer, maybe it isn't. But in my view, the calculus is not grounded in Jewish law. The calculus is grounded in real politics. And finally, I want to give the example of abortion. And I want to use this example specifically to disagree with an assumption that, perhaps more than an assumption, that Dr. Novak makes. There are situations in Jewish law where Jewish law is more lenient and to how it perceives the rights of Jews than how it perceives the rights of Gentiles. And thus, Jewish law permits abortions, in my understanding of Jewish law, in many circumstances where it does not permit, where it recognizes that the universal morality ought not to permit abortions, and that sometimes Jewish law is more lenient than the universal morality. And this has to do with a complex theological discussion about the relationship between universal morality and Jewish law. And thus, it is impossible to craft an abortion law that is both consistent with my understanding of Jewish law and my understanding of the universal code that governs non-Jews. Such an abortion law cannot be crafted. Unless, of course, you're prepared to allow government to make distinctions based on one's right, one's religious faith, before one can have an abortion, which is preposterous in America. So the solution, in my view, to the abortion dilemma is, again, not grounded in the Jewish tradition. It's at its core grounded in political realism as to what maximizes religious rights. So I return to the beginning, and then I'll sit down. In my view, the Jewish tradition has clear views of morality, and those clear views of morality are articulated in the synagogue. It has much less clear views of morality that ought to be articulated out of the synagogue, and even though it recognizes a universal morality, it doesn't believe we need to articulate it. And thus, when it comes to determining governmental policy and Jewish political views, civic participation in American life, we are real politic, and we are not advocating a position grounded in morality. Thank you very much.
I hope we get to pursue this frontal disagreement in the question and answers. Dr. Gottsagen.
Hi there. Thank you for coming. Thank you for inviting me. And now for something completely different. Not completely different, but the my discussion will be framed in terms of a different set of issues and vocabularies. The question that I want to address is whether religion, and Judaism in particular, can be a force for the renewal of American public life, and especially American political life. Now, Jews are wary, to generalize, of the signs of a return of religion to the public square, to generalize. When Senator Lieberman was nominated, Jews were thrilled. But when he wore his religion on his sleeve, so to speak, when he invoked his religious faith as a justification for some of his political convictions and positions, many Americans were worried and, in fact, were silently sympathetic to the position of Abe Foxman, who said, basically, Senator Lieberman, we've had a long experience with what happens when religion is in the public square, and if memory serves, that generally doesn't work out too good for the Jews, so you should know better and cool it. And that was the, and I think in large measure that sentiment expressed by Foxman, in fact, resonates with a deep anxiety, I wouldn't even say ambivalence, just anxiety on the part of many secular Jews, many Jews, religious or otherwise, who are nervous because they cannot imagine that the return of religion to the public square could mean anything other than the return of the cross. Now, the question for me, though, is whether that anxiety is well-placed. Well, no, the anxiety is well-placed, but whether the anxiety should be sufficient to preclude the endeavor to bring the two together, religion and public life. The on the one hand, the secularization of the public square, the separation of church and state, has been a great boon to Jews individually, socially, economically, politically, and I think that's a generally fair argument. And of course, it's no surprise that Jews since 1945 were especially involved in the efforts to secularize the American public square, that the American Jewish Congress was at the fore of these efforts. And as I said, it's been good for the Jews in many ways, and good for many, and good for not only for the Jews. I mean, good for members of religious minorities who would otherwise not have had the full range of opportunities that American society makes available. The question, though, or the problem, is that this secularization, separation of church and state, in its militant form, whatever that would mean, has a downside, that even Jews and other religious minorities should acknowledge. And my sense of the price paid has been a certain loss of affection for the common good, a certain loss of appreciation for the nobility of political life, that the secularization of American society has elevated the economic sphere and, in effect, subordinated the political sphere. And my sense is that religion's role in political life might be to elevate politics, to bring the common good to the fore as a concern, as an animating object of public affection and zeal, and to turn politics once again into a quasi-religious calling. So my argument is that the separation of church and state, not only that, the the intensification of the American economy, of modern economic life, has seen this diminution, this of the status of politics. And again, my contention is that religion might be a resource that we as Americans can look to revivify American political life. Now, it's interesting, Robert Bella, a sociologist, made an argument about, let's see, 1967, that America is uniquely dependent upon religion for its well-being. And now he wasn't talking actually about congregational religions in the sense of, he wasn't talking about the Jewish, he wasn't talking about synagogues, he wasn't talking about churches, he wasn't talking about mosques and the communities associated therewith. He was rather talking about what he called civil religion. He spoke of the American civil religion, which he believed was absolutely essential for the maintenance of a certain quality of life in America. And basically, his argument was that America is an interesting kind of republic. And I think it holds, I think the argument has a lot to recommend it. And I'm going to have one qualification at the end. But he says that America is an interesting kind of republic. America was born of this republican tradition, which was very much intent upon creating a citizenry that was dedicated to the public good and dedicated to the political life. And the concern, though, expressed by all the theorists that our founding fathers read, was if you try to create a republic and the populace is too busy tending to their economics, not only will that, let's say, economic egotism of the market or possessive individualism, not only will that distract people from politics, in the sense that if people are trained to seek their own personal good or their own private good, they may prefer going into business to participating in town meetings. Of course, that's the case. And secondarily, he was the tradition is concerned that that politics itself will be corrupted by money, that the self-seeking behavior, which is ostensibly going on in the economy, will actually end up shaping the ethos that people bring to bear in politics themselves. So politics will become the continuation of economics, or economic competition, or group competition, as